Welcome back to the Mel Kay Show. Thank you for joining me. You know my guest today. I cannot tell you how much I've learned from this guy, and he has a great lesson for us today. One of the smartest people around, and I'm honored to have him every time. Thank you for joining me, Matt Arett.
Thank you, Mel. Always a pleasure. And I know this is a long time coming. We discussed this. I think we floated this at the end of one of our interviews, one of our shows 2 months ago or so. And we're like, okay, we're going to do something specifically breaking down Abraham Lincoln's greenbacks. Right. And we'll make it more of like a class lecture structured thing that we don't usually do. Because I'll make some PowerPoint, I'll make some images, some stats. So, and we never did it. So just, you know, things happen. We're finally doing it. So, and I know I've gotten messages. So I saw that on Twitter, people messaging you, messaging me saying, hey, when are you going to do this class? So we're doing it.
Yeah.
So I'm excited. I made a few images, as I promised. And also I found a little video that I want to start with. And this video, we'll do share sound here. Let's see if this works. If it doesn't work, can you see my my screen?
Yeah, I see it.
There okay. You go. It's a short Fox News clip of the cobalt miner conditions in Congo.
Right.
I believe it's Congo. It might be somewhere else, but I think it's Congo. Let's see.
Africans work in extreme heat and dangerous conditions for pennies. In America, we call that illegal. But Biden, AOC, call that the Green New Deal. But children halfway around the world are the ones paying the price. They spend all day covered in toxic chemicals to make your electric car. Mothers with newborn babies strapped to their chests are mining in dark pits. Biden would never let this happen in America because you actually have to pay American workers a decent wage. And then the Green New Deal gets more expensive, and it's already too expensive. But since this is in Africa, we don't hear about it. And we don't think anybody should buy an electric car without knowing that this happens. Siddhartha Kara, author of Cobalt Red, How the Blood of the...
All right, I want to start just with that little clip, just to situate this presentation on the USA in the 19th century. Because some things have changed and some things have stayed the same. But the slavery today, just like we had, I mean, you know, slavery was a big thing in the 19th century. And most of human civilization's history, the idea of owning human beings as property was not abnormal. This is a relatively new phenomenon where we have passed laws and made it normalized to say that, no, owning another human being is not lawful. It's not right. But in reality, when you look at like how globalization is wired, how is the Davos, how is the Bilderberger Group, how is globalization, which has been created especially over the dead bodies of people like John F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, in order to create this whole global system of dependence on cheap labor, exploitation of resources, this is not that different from slavery in many ways. Although one could say, oh, but you know, we're paying the child laborer. There's 40,000. Kids just in Congo alone working in these mines. Many of them are for, as Jesse Waters was saying, for cobalt and other rare earths, for the Green New Deal, to support electric car batteries, to support photovoltaic cells, which require massive, massive inputs of destructive mining operations. People would say, oh, these children, these people who are maybe not children, you know, but are still working in abusive conditions around Africa and in South America, at least they get paid 25 cents a day. So they're not really slaves because we're paying them 25 cents a day. Now, okay, you could say that, but in reality, you know, deep down inside, if you paid them a dollar a day, if you paid them a wage on parallel to the type of wage expected by the developed sector workers, the system wouldn't work. So we're dependent upon those inputs. And it happened even before the days of the Green New Deal. So we got this whole system. Now, this is where I'd like to launch into the presentation. So let me do a little screen share again. Second. Sorry. I'm just not seeing my PowerPoint, but it's there somewhere. Here it is. Okay. And the fact as well, we were chatting, the fact that the Green New Deal is being promoted by people and who are in charge in the Biden administration, like John Podesta, the Clintons, the people who are the most, I mean, I'm not even going to get into Pizzagate, but I mean, in terms of those who are the worst human beings in the world are the ones in charge, right. Maury Strong, you know, one of the most rampant Luciferian figures who worked for the Rockefeller machine. And it was the co-creator of the Green New Deal back in the 1970s. The fact that these are the creatures shows a direct continuity to the same machine, the same machinations that were trying to destroy America back in 1861 when the first shots rang out and the Civil War begun. The idea was to always destroy and undo what the United States Patriots had created in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence and finalized in 1789 with the Constitution. That had to be undone. And the best way that empires operate for this sort of thing is divide and conquer. If you can't destroy it physically from the outside, try to break it up from within as anything that you want to target, destroy from within. So the Civil War was a big thing. Now, I chose to call this little presentation Lincoln's Greenbacks and Master Key in Saving the Union. There's, as I said, other parallels too, obviously. The layout, the breakdown of the United States today has a lot of parallels to what we saw in the buildup to the Civil War as well, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's unmistakable. The amount of, and it's understandable. It's totally understandable why this graph on the right featuring the abundance of voices of people, of citizens living in these various states of America want to secede. I get it. And that's become actually a very popular movement amongst the truth community, as it's so called, is to have a national divorce with the idea that things are going to get better, that that we're just going to be able to end the empire just by, you know, breaking away, doing what was attempted back 150 years ago. But, you know, and maybe having, usually this is colored with this philosophy of having micro communities, decentralization, everybody going small, going Amish. And somehow we're going to be able to sort of survive and beat back this global deep state satanic empire with its controls of military industrial systems, all of this stuff, space-based lasers, GMO mosquitoes with like vaccine powers. We're going to be able to just somehow end that by just creating our own little microsystems. And I got to say, in my view, my analysis thus far is that is a sure recipe for getting our asses and our families killed and enslaved if those are not killed. It's a trap, even though I get it. I get why it's desired. And a lot of this, I think, has to do with the sense of a lack of sense of victory. People have been demoralized. They've been made obviously cynical a bit. And so that emotional tone has created a situation where people want to do what was attempted back in the 19th century. But as I'm going to say, and as Donald Trump knows, because I'm assuming if people are listening to this, there's a fair chance either you're working for intelligence and you're just like sort of profiling the alternative media community, or the majority of people actually do like Donald Trump and do want to take back the nation. They probably want to know why Trump said the following things. Because Trump was actually calling for using national power to break the controls of the oligarchy, create national policies and international policies based upon entente, cooperation with Russia, development that would have made a lot of money and will make a lot of money if we're able to win this fight again for big business, for the people, to bring back manufacturing to America all across the United States that has been hollowed out by years of globalization. Trump wanted to bring that back, and he would have used the national power available to him as president, which has an immense amount of power to advance that program, as we saw for the 4 years, even though his hands were tied and he was being sabotaged by this deep state operation. Even despite that, we saw the evidence of that. He said repeatedly that we have to bring the Republican Party back to the spirit of Abraham Lincoln. And again, a lot of people who like Trump don't like Lincoln. So I'm going to say a few things about this. But he said in 2019, the Republican Party, the Republican Party, the party of Abraham Lincoln, goes forward united, determined, and ready to welcome millions of Democrats, independents, and anyone who believes in the greatness of America and the righteous heart of the American people. And he said a little bit earlier in another speech in Kentucky, the American model is the system of that our founders wanted. Our greatest American leaders, including George Washington, Hamilton, Jackson, who I disagree with, but anyway, Lincoln, they all agreed that for America to be a strong nation, it must also be a great manufacturing nation. So yeah. Trump definitely understood something very important about Lincoln. There's been a lot of slander against Lincoln, and that has to do with the fact that I think the oligarchy that's been trying to bring about this one world government of depopulation for the entire time that after Lincoln died, even before Lincoln, right, during the fight and then afterwards, that same oligarchy that never disappeared after the Civil War was never American. It never disappeared. It was never expunged, although the patriots in America did gain an immense amount of power, of influence after the Civil War, and spread this American system, as Trump called it, understood it to be called. That's how it was self-referenced around the world, to patriots in Russia, to Japan, to Europe, to South America, to France, to Germany. And one of the key figures who organized this was a leading figure who helped co-found the Republican Party itself in 1856, which was the anti-slave party. It was better understood that the Democratic Party machine was the party of slavery. It was the party of Wall Street. And it was the Republican Party set up by one of Lincoln's key advisors, who became a champion of the system after Lincoln was murdered, spreading it around the world. It was Henry C. Carey. And Henry C. Carey wrote a book called The Harmony of Interests. I know of this because I was a volunteer for many years with the LaRouche Organization and the Schiller Institute up until 2017. And that's when I first, during that time, I encountered a lot of this stuff. So for those who want to look into this a little bit more, I would suggest read Alan Salisbury's books, his research on Henry C. Carey and the American system. I'll send you a link to share around if you, after this, this presentation.
Good. Yeah, good.
Henry C. Carey forecasting the inevitable civil war, which was always being manufactured and manipulated by external forces outside of America itself and their fifth columnists within America, managing Wall Street, managing the slave power. These are fifth column. It's not authentically American. Said and foresaw that two systems are before the world. One looks to increasing the proportion of persons and of capital engaged in trade and transportation, and therefore to diminishing the proportion engaged in production of commodities with which to trade, with necessarily diminished returns to the labor of all, while the other looks to increasing the proportion engaged in the work of production and diminishing that engaged in trade and transportation, with increased returns to all, giving to the laborer good wages and to the owner of capital good profits. One looks to underworking the Hindu and sinking the rest of the world to his level, the other to raising the standard of man throughout the world to our level. One looks to pauperism, ignorance, depopulation, and barbarism. The other, in increasing wealth, comfort, intelligence, combination of action and civilization. One looks towards universal war, the other towards universal peace. One is the English system, the other we may be proud to call the American system. For it is the only one ever devised, the tendency of which was that of elevating while equalizing the condition of man throughout the world. That's a beautiful
I know. Well, doesn't
summary.
Wish he was around now.
Yeah. But the spirit of Carey
That sounds like the divide that we're living through at this moment is I think that at least with the people that we speak to, I think that's kind of where we are. In a lot of ways.
Yeah. And the reason why I really wanted to begin with this is because people often treat the U.S. history with two fallacies that have been promoted. One is to treat it as if it was a U.S. experience. The Civil War is a purely U.S. Phenomenon. Not true. You can't understand anything if you think in those terms and you don't look at the broader global chemistry. Number two, they treat it as if it were about slavery alone, as if that's all it was, without recognizing that it was much more than that. And it had a lot to do with what Henry C. Carey just pointed out, which is the battle over economic systems. And there was parallels between the British capitalist system, which used human exploitation. It did not have the idea that human life was sacred. That was not there. You know, they were working little children in Charles Dickens, you know, yeah. Tale of Two Cities totally. Type of abuse environments. And 20% of the population was stuck in the British textile mills. They were using the British East India Company as a global private corporation with its own armies in order to use capitalism as a cover to actually justify the destruction of India, of China, of Ireland, around the world. So the idea was to use capitalism as a cover to enforce population control, divide to conquer, starvation for better controls, not for making money. They didn't really care about capital. They cared about control. And then you have
I want to say something, one sec. I just realized something through this. I knew I would because you're like professor, you are a professor actually. Because this is important. And I just dawned on me, not that it's the first time, but I really do want to say this about the Civil War and about slavery, because a lot of times people don't understand that it wasn't just about slavery, but because of the context and what you put up here that Carrie was saying at the time, this is a lot bigger than that, because I think that the narrative that's been created, especially by people like the 1619 Project and others that are out there using the CRT and you're oppressed, oppressor, is that the people that had slaves just had slaves for pure evil, that they were just evil people that wanted to enslave people. No, they were using people to do work and labor for as cheap as possible to get away with it, which is still going on to this day. But you know, I feel like the idea that sometimes, I'm glad you're doing this, because that gets left out of the conversation a lot, that it did, as it does now, have a lot to do with money, resources, labor, wages, all of that. A lot of the people that were slave owners, it had a lot more to do with their financial endgame. And it did with those, they weren't looking at them as people. They certainly were looking at them as they own them, a commodity, but it wasn't just pure, like, you know, this is like a rant talking about Eichmann. It wasn't just pure evil. It was truly different level, evil plus greed plus, you know, well, this is how I'm going to keep power. It's just interesting to think about the Civil War in terms of the financial side and being fair to people as versus owning people, as paying people a fair wage for good life, as averse to not paying them a fair wage, owning them and having slaves. It just, people never get to that next step of, well, what was slavery about? Because it wasn't just pure evil. It was, a lot of it was about money and greed. Go ahead.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And of course, as soon as you put yourself in a position where you become dependent upon somebody staying in a lower life potential than you, seeing their life is not being sacred because they don't have rights to have freedom because they're inferior in some way. As soon as you let that in your heart, of course, a little bit of the oligarchy in the inner echelons of the upper controllers is going to be awoken inside of you as well. A little oligarch will start forming and shaping your own identity, even though you yourself are kind of a slave to the system, right? You're like, and Frederick Douglass, my wife wrote a book going through a lot of this stuff, and Cynthia Chung, and she made the point that, you know, in reading Frederick Douglass's autobiography, who was a freed slave who worked and advised Lincoln, he even noted after the Emancipation Proclamation and after slavery was abolished, he went and visited. It was safe to travel in the former slave states, and he visited his former slave master on his deathbed and said, "I forgive you because we were both slaves ultimately." That was a big deal. I don't know if I could have done that, but he did that and he got that. That's true. Like, you know, and most people were not themselves slave owners in the slave South. It was a small minority who actually had the money to own human beings. It was a bit expensive, you know.
I think they've suppressed Frederick Douglass in history as well, because I think Frederick Douglass, if people actually understood him, and I know movies in Hollywood have been put up thousands, like hundreds of times, and they never get financed or put out. But he's a really important person, I think, in this whole period of time that you're talking about, to really dispel a lot of myths and say a lot of truth. Because there's still people out there that think that it was Lincoln and the Republican Party and all of that that really were behind slavery. I mean, just the lies about slavery as opposed to the truth from actual people like Frederick Douglass are so different that I just want to recommend to everyone to read Frederick Douglass's autobiography, and you will never look at any of it the same. Go ahead.
Absolutely. So here's the thing. Now, There's actually an 1858 speech. It's part of the debates between the Lincoln Douglas debates. Stephen Douglas, who was a Democrat running for Senate, and he was a judge who was a big proponent of Dred Scott and the whole slave power. And there was a series of debates, and this was an extract from one of them before Lincoln became president, where he described, because people say, oh, it wasn't about slavery. Lincoln said it's about saving the Union. He would not free a slave if he could save the Union. Now, that's a fallacy completely, because Lincoln was on record going back to the 1830s calling for the need to free slaves. And it was, in fact, the reason why as soon as Lincoln was elected president, that you had the immediate announcement by five and then quickly seven states that they were going to secede under a new Confederacy, because they knew that their system that was dependent upon slave labor, and we're going to see more of that, was now jeopardized. So to say, oh, Lincoln didn't, because of this one quote, no context, thus it was all a fraud, we've all been lied to, it wasn't about slavery. No, I'm sorry. It was absolutely about slavery. And Lincoln united the whole fight against global imperialism and the slave factor in the United States as part of the same fight, correctly so, as Henry C. Carey did, who helped co-found the Republican Party with Lincoln around the same time, where he said, that is the issue that will continue in this country when these poor tongues of Judge Douglas and myself shall be silent. It is the eternal struggle between these two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world. They are the two principles that have stood face to face from the beginning of time and will ever continue to struggle. The one is the common right of humanity, and the other, the divine right of kings. Just like the global empire requires the idea of hereditary powers, that's what the founding fathers broke away from, is this idea that your authority to rule or have any of the privileges is purely based on the betterness, the superiority of your blood and your hereditary bloodlines. And that gives you right to be masters as monarchs over the, or lords or knight sirs or whatever hereditary title you want, the many who must be born into lower families with lower blood as slaves in varieties of ways. That is inextricably tied to the slave ethic, the slave master ethic that was corrupting the United States from within. Now for destroyed, you know, if he destroyed 500,000 or 600,000 American lives through this unnecessary civil war. And I've been in debates in public platforms where people have actually said this to me, that slavery would have just naturally disappeared if he just let them be, let them go have their own nation. Slavery would have dissipated. I say to that, listen to the words of the Confederate vice president himself, Alexander Stevens, on February 1st, 1861, right when Lincoln is elected and right when they're announcing a breakaway new nation, a new Confederacy. He says, our Confederacy is founded upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery is his natural and normal condition. Our new government is the first in the history of the world based on this great physical and moral truth. People can verify this if they want to. And the second thing I would say, this creepy, creepy character. Yeah, who probably never lifted a hammer in his life. Real blue blood. Right? That's why they call them blue bloods, because their skin was effeminate and like pasty, because they never got sun and never did any work. They call them like the Boston Blue Bloods, or the slave power Blue Bloods, because again, they had, like, he was probably being carried around by a couple of like black strong slaves or something, and you know, they were really addicted to privilege. It's super gross.
Yeah, but they still exist, people. These kind. I mean, they do. And no matter what anyone says, let me tell you something. The people that are doing this debt slavery model, like you brought up in the beginning, in Africa and South America, and quite honestly, in America, these globalist elite oligarchs, they still feel that way, in my opinion. And it's not just about black people. It's about anyone that they consider below them. So yes, it's just, it's really sick. But again, this guy, again, isn't just a Confederate. He's also a Democrat. So,
yeah. And he's the vice president of the Confederacy. And he was working as well to create the Confederate Constitution that was made public on March 11th, 1861, which says explicitly within the Constitution itself, people can go online, read it, It literally said in Article 1, Section 9, that no bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law denying or impairing the right to, of property in Negro slaves shall be passed. Ugh. They're basically saying that with this new nation, it will be anti-constitutional to pass any law or bill that frees slaves. So they're enshrining slavery forever in the Constitution as a forever thing. And Article 4, Section 2 says the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all the privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states and shall have the right of transit and sojourn in any state of this Confederacy with their slaves and other property, and the right of property in said slaves shall not be thereby impaired. So, yeah, you could travel anywhere within the states with your property. And that one's useful just to get across that when people say, oh, yeah, Lincoln deprived us. This is usually like the libertarian network. They're like, oh, yeah, Lincoln deprived citizens of their right to property. And it's like, yeah, OK, what was that property? Did the property talk? Was it talking property? Because, you know, there's no differentiation. Yeah. Like, oh, but you owned it. You have a bill of sale, purchase. Thus, it's property. And we've lost the ability to identify that was never, human beings were never a legitimate form of property in the eyes of God. So we've lost that ability of discerning, moral discernment. So that's useful to keep in mind. And the last article, and there's other disgusting things in here, but the other one on this slide that I thought was useful was Article 4, Section 3, Part 3. No slave or other person held to service or labor in any state or territory of the Confederate States, escaping or lawfully carried into another, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered upon claim of the party to whom such slave belongs. So they basically took the Dred Scott law that had really just been passed by Taney a few years earlier, which is that, you know, if a slave escapes to another state, then it is in the federal protection of the slave master to reacquire the property of said escaped slave. And they're basically saying that that's not just an edict by a judge. That is going to be part of our Constitution.
It's truly hard to believe. It's hard to believe, Matt, that there was ever a human being that could ever write this stuff. I mean, and the saddest part is what's making me so upset reading this is that slavery is just as bad right now, as you and I know, and there's all different kinds of children and slaves all over the world right now. People don't even realize, but just imagine. So to people that don't understand, you know, the banality of evil, people were writing this, and I'm sure just like Noah Harari talking up there and to a standing ovation, there were people in this room, obviously in Alabama, when they were ratifying this, that were like, great idea. Yay. You know, that there was that much. Yeah. It's so shocking. Go ahead. I'm sorry, but I never saw this.
No, it's useful. It's good to just soak back the unnaturalness of this. You're right.
I mean,
totally
I'm thinking
right.
of all the slaves now, you know, there's so many slaves now, be it sex slaves, labor slaves, slaves, you know, all over the Middle East, all over the world.
No, sick. I know. Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry. Yeah.
No, don't be sorry at all. The other thing within the Confederate Constitution, which ties back into the unifying theme of the economic fight over exploitation and the owning of slave issue, is Article 1, Section 8, which says that no bounties shall be granted from the Treasury, nor shall any duties or taxes on importations. That is no protectionism, no revenue that occurs from protective tariffs when you tax imports of foreign goods. Be laid or to promote or foster any branch of industry. So within the actual Confederate Constitution, it actually says, in direct opposition to the U.S. Constitution, which is the opposite wording, the opposite philosophy, that industrial growth will not be developed, that no revenue of the state will be permitted by the constitutional law to ever go into supporting manufacturing factories industry. Why? Well, it's because the whole system was wired on human brute labor force. And we're going to say a little bit more detail about that.
Right.
Wow. Lord Robert Cecil, Gascoigne Cecil, he was one of the key handlers of Cecil Rhodes later on. No, just a coincidence.
Interesting.
There.
Interesting.
Yeah, the Gascoigne Cecil clan was a high-level family that really came to prominence with the Venetian takeover of Britain in 1688, earlier on. And they've ever since, and still to this day, remain one of the highest, or among the highest of the family, the inner echelon families. And he made a point. He became he became prime minister for a sustained period after this quote. But he was a member of parliament. The House of Lords, where he said the northern states of America can never be our true friends because we are rivals. Rivals politically, rivals commercially. With the southern states, the case is entirely reversed. The population are an agricultural people. They furnish the raw material to our industry and they consume the products which we manufacture from it. With them, every interest must lead us to cultivate friendly relations. And when the war began, they at once recurred to England as their natural ally. So what's he basically saying in the House of Lords? The North, because the North has manufacturing, they cannot be our allies because Britain wants global monopoly on manufacturing. And